0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Lifeline. 51551 is our text number. joe@rte.ie is the simple email from anywhere in the world. Now, Carl, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe.
What, you were walking through a cemetery?
Yeah, Dean's Grange in Harold's Cross.
No, it's
Sunday.
It's Mount Jerome in Harold's Cross.
Oh, Mount Jerome, sorry.
Okay, don't bother, okay.
It was very, very quiet, and mm-hmm. I was just moseying around looking at the tombstones, and some of them are obviously there a long time, but I came across this very well cared for a grave near a tree down in a little corner,
okay.
And it had the UN logo on it.
Okay.
And it said, in loving memory of my dear husband, Frank, who gave his life in the cause of peace, Nuala, Northern Rhodesia, September 18th, 1961.
Okay.
And that caught my eye because Northern Rhodesia, what is today called Zambia,
mm-hmm.
and I knew there was no Irish Army soldiers there. They were across the border in Katanga.
In the Congo,
at that
yeah.
time. So, the other side of the grave had the name Evers, E-I-V-E-R-S, which
okay.
I'm more familiar with the name Ivers, but Evers. And I just thought it was very unusual. And when I got home, I Googled and I found mm-hmm. on the County Roscommon Archaeological and Historical Society website, which is a great little website, there, lo and behold, was poor Frank Evers, a little summary of his life. But I was just intrigued, and I'd never heard of this before. And the fact that he was bodyguard to Dag Hammarskjöld, I think his name was, who
yeah.
at that time is Secretary General of the United Nations.
Yeah, yeah.
Described, by the way, by
John F. Kennedy as the greatest statesman of the 20th century. Dag Hammarskjöld was Secretary General of the UN for a long number, youngest ever. And but did you find out any more? Like, was Frank Ivers, was he a Garda when he was bodyguard?
It looked like he was seconded or took leave of absence, but it must have been with Garda blessing, because otherwise he would have had to resign. And he was obviously a very able person, because he joined the Guards in 1953,
mm-hmm.
and he was promoted sergeant in 1956, so after only 3 years. And he was appointed a lieutenant. Now, I'm not sure in what force, but
mm-hmm.
He was a lieutenant with the UN, I presume. So he seems to be in a very, and he seems to be very popular in the Guards as well. I wasn't able to find anything else about him,
okay,
so I thought I'd email your programme.
Yeah, and we said about yesterday, thanks to your tip-off or our curiosity, and I'm sure many other people have been walking through graveyards and wondered what this was. So what piqued your interest was, one, the UN logo.
Okay. Yeah.
Two, that he was mentioned Northern Rhodesia. Even
yeah.
though 6,000 Irish soldiers served in the Congo between 1664, but this was 1961. Did it make any mention of this, the assassination of Dag Hammarskjöld?
No.
Okay. No reference.
Just where he was killed, that was it.
But he was killed.
Just where.
So if that's...
Thank you.
Because Dag Hammarskjöld's plane was blown up when he was secretary. He was
yeah.
the Antonio Guterres of his day, so that's how important it was. He was trying to broker peace in Congo stroke Katanga, as indeed the Conor Cruz O'Brien was involved, as we know, and the Irish Army were heavily, heavily involved,
yeah.
6,000 soldiers over the 4 years. But was there any reference to the fact that in the assassination of the Secretary General of the United Nations, an Irishman was also killed?
As far as I know.
Well, we managed to contact Lizzie Dolan. Lizzie, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
You are
to talk to you.
Likewise, you're very good, Lizzie, for coming on, because you are I know he died in 1961, which is a long time. But you are Frank's sister, Frank Ivor's sister.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Your brother was only, 28 when he was killed?
28, yeah. When he joined the Guards in Kevin Street in Dublin.
Yeah.
And then he was sent to the United Nations in America.
Okay.
And he was sent from there out to the Congo for a number, I think a year or so, and came back in. And then he was picked for Derek Hammarskjöld's guard.
Bodyguard.
And went with him.
Yeah.
And that's where it happened. And
there was 14 people on that plane.
There was 14.
Which was shot
with
down.
Him, and they were all, yeah, the whole lot was killed.
And
I have a sister in New York. I had a sister in New York. Okay. A nursing her now. But she did her level best to try and get in touch with the UN to find out, and never did.
To find out what happened to your brother?
Yeah, never found out.
It's still a mystery.
Up to this. Yeah, still a mystery.
Well, we know the plane was blown up, but they don't know whether there was a bomb on board or it was taken down by so-called enemy forces, or indeed the rebels in the Congo.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about Frank, because what age were you when he was killed, Lizzie? And do you remember being aware of the fact that your only brother had been killed?
Well, when we heard it, of course, you saw nothing, you heard nothing, and we couldn't deal with it, you know. And it's like he never died to this day, you know.
Why do you say that?
Because we never saw anything.
Yeah.
Or anything.
There was
very little talked about.
And was his body ever found, Lizzie?
No, sure, we don't know.
Yeah.
We don't know anything like that. No.
Was there ever a funeral for him?
There was a funeral. Yeah, he was brought back to Dublin and he was buried in Mount Jerome. And there was the guards. The guards looked after everything in Dublin.
Okay.
You know, they did everything.
Now, I presume, given that Frank was quite young when he was killed in this attack. 28 in this attack.
28.
Were your parents still alive, Lizzie?
My mother was alive.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure.
And how did she take it?
It's like if nothing happened, you know.
Yeah.
Because when you don't see a body or something, and it was all done away, and you don't know what went down.
And Lizzie, do you mind me asking you this question? What is in the grave that Carl came across in Mount Jerome in Dublin on Sunday? What is in that grave?
Some kind of a coffin anyway, of some kind, I don't know.
But what's in the coffin? What's in the coffin?
We don't know.
Because it
we
is...
We never did know. So we don't know.
What do you think? Is this hard to hear? Do you think, Lizzie, because the plane was blown up in the Northern Rhodesia, Zambia now, at the time, and no survivors, obviously. Obviously, it was an explosion on a plane at a height, so your imagination runs riot. Do you think there's anything in the coffin?
Well, I don't think so. I don't think so.
And tell us a little bit about Frank. He had just been married.
He'd been married, was 2 weeks or 3. Mother married anyhow, and he was called up for the UN. And
He was 4 weeks married.
I think that's it. And he was called up for the UN, and he said he'd go. And off he went and left his wife behind him in Dublin.
Yeah.
And from there then, we don't know anymore. And he was sent to the Congo for a while. When Dean came back, and then he went to the United Nations.
And he became the personal bodyguard of Dag Hammarskjöld. Now, he was married on August the 19th, 1961, and he was killed 1 month and 2 days later.
2 days.
September
yeah,
the 21st, 19. My yeah. God.
Yeah. And 28 years of age.
And do you mind me asking, Lizzie, who did your brother marry? Who was his wife?
Mary Hyland. She was from Dublin.
Okay.
Don't harass me. Can't remember. But she was from Dublin. And God bless her.
Yeah.
She was very good to him. And she was going to go to the United Nations as well after.
Yeah.
And she didn't get the chance.
To try and find out what happened. And
she tried and happened. My sister tried and everyone tried. No result.
Okay.
Whatsoever. Although, maybe this month now is an anniversary. And my sister's husband in New York said that he had was in touch with reporters in America about it. So maybe it's going to start again. I don't know.
Because it's one of the great... sorry, Carl, yes?
Yeah. Joe, I just it might be of interest to Lizzie as well. I'm just looking at foreignpolicy.com, and in February 15, 2022, the UN General Secretary, Antonio Guterres, marked the 60th anniversary of the death of his predecessor, Dag Hammarskjöld, et cetera, by laying a wreath alongside the names of other fallen UN staffers. But in his tribute, which hails the late Swedish diplomat as a noble servant of peace, Guterres neglected to mention any of the 15 other UN advisors, bodyguards and crew members who also perished above his airliner. And it seems to, just by glancing through this, some of the other relatives of the victims feel that the UN has deliberately ignored their relatives and hasn't really looked into really what happened.
And Dag Hammarskjöld was posthumously awarded the Nobel Peace Prize as well. So he's well remembered and rightly so. And indeed, his father was a prime minister of Sweden at one stage. So he's well remembered and rightly so. But Lizzie, is there anyone else from your family in that grave in Harold's Cross in Dublin, Mount Jerome?
No.
It's just that is the marker for Frank's name. Now, was Frank, insofar as you know, Lizzie, was your brother Frank Ivers, was he a Garda when he was in, he was still a Garda, was he as such?
He was still a Garda in Kevin Street when he volunteered to go with the United Nations.
And could he have come back? The reason I'm asking, was he still a guard, is that Frank's name, again, this is difficult, Frank's name is not on the Garda Roll of Honour in Dublin Castle, which is for Gardaí killed in the line of duty. And Frank was killed in the line of duty.
He was. But sure, look at it.
Yeah.
It's like if... we weren't there, or he knew nobody belonged to. You know, so you don't know what went on.
And is there Carl spotted the one in Mount Jerome in Dublin. And he said it's very well kept, Lizzie. And who looks after that for the family?
My niece looks after it.
Well, she's done a fantastic job, because Carl has sent us in a photograph, and with your permission, we'll show people the photograph of how beautifully kept it is. But you believe that is because of the nature of what happened, unfortunately, that is an empty grave, but that is a memorial to your fallen brother, Garda Sergeant Frank Ivers. Now, is there a plaque anywhere else to him, Lizzie?
Oh, just beside the house here now, where I live.
Oh, great.
Where he was born. There's two plaques, you know. Right beside the house.
Okay. And who put them up? Who erected them, Lizzie?
Oh, the local committee.
Great, okay. Committee was set up.
That's it. Okay. Yeah, fair juice to them, that is.
Well done, well done.
Yeah, and, well done, that's right.
And did you ever get any... Obviously, Frank was with Dag Hammarskjöld, the UN General Secretary, he was his bodyguard. He would have been based in New York. Did you ever get any... Do you know, Lizzie, I know it's a long time ago, and I really appreciate your memory, but do you know if your family ever got Frank's personal effects back to the home place?
No.
No.
Never.
Nothing.
Never got anything. My sister tries United Nations in America. No good. No. Never heard. Yeah, it is unbelievable. So it's hard to know what went wrong.
And of the family, Lizzie, I know Frank was an only boy.
Only boy, yeah.
And
he
had many sisters?
There's just two of us left now. Ah. One in Manchester and myself here in the home place.
And the two of you are still carrying the flame for your brother.
Oh, we are.
Of course,
hoping.
The torch. Yeah, rightly so.
Hoping.
Rightly so.
Yeah, hoping.
Would you like to see his name on the Garda Memorial in Dublin Castle?
I would. Because he did a lot of good work.
And he was obviously very, very bright.
He was.
Was he?
Well, he just went to the Marist College in Athlone,
okay.
And then played for the Guards and got it, and that's it.
But within three years, he was a sergeant.
That's it.
And then very shortly afterwards, he was seconded to the UN. So somebody picked him, and somebody said, "This guy is good at his job and has great promise." And unfortunately, as you say, less than a month after being married, at the age of 28, he was in the plane. Yeah. That was shot down. Yeah. And Carl, you're insofar as you're, I know you're reading up there as we speak, but you believe that when they had a memorial, I presume it was in 2021, given that the Dag Hammarskjöld was and the 14 people were assassinated in 1961. You say there was no mention of the fact that there was 14 other people on that plane.
Yes, according to this report in foreignpolicy.com, which I think is
a fairly reputable. Yeah, it is.
They said that the omission rankled many descendants of the crash victims, who took it as the latest sign that the United Nations has been conducting a listless investigation into one of the diplomacy's most extraordinary cold cases of the 20th century. So the relatives, there's a number of them here, I won't dare pronounce their names.
Okay.
A lot of them seem to be German or Swedish. But I can send you the link.
But I presume Frank, from our point of view, Frank was the only Irish person on board.
The only Irish person, yes. Yeah.
Okay. Carl, can you explain the background to the... I know you've written a book on Irish military vehicles and you have a great interest in Irish military history. Can you explain why the Irish Army was in the Congo in the 60s?
Well, the problem was that when the Belgians gave independence to the Congo, there was a very wealthy... in terms of mineral resources and uranium, etc.,
province
called Katanga.
Yeah.
And the Belgian mining company, which basically ran Katanga, they took umbrage at the fact that Patrice Lumumba, the new president of the Congo, was slightly left-wing, and they basically decided to topple them. Now, the problem was that the West was getting, like America, I think, was one of the principal customers, but also France and Britain, for uranium. And this was at the height of the Cold War. And if they were worried that if the Russians got their hands on the uranium mines in Katanga, that would deny them supplies for, it was such a time when all the powers were making nuclear bombs. And... Basically, the Katangans rebelled from the Congolese government and tried to set up their own little mini state under a local man called Chombi. And behind him were the Belgians, the Belgian government and the Belgian mining company.
Okay.
And as far as I can see, Hammarskjöld seems to have been flying to Northern Rhodesia to meet Chombe to discuss some sort of peace settlement. But there may have been a lot of people who didn't want that to happen. And obviously, chief suspects would be the Belgian mining company. I think they were called Minière.
As you say it, a lot of these names are coming back to us because of Jadaville, the Irish army, the incredible bravery of the Irish soldiers in Jadaville, the fact that they were ignored again by the Irish military hierarchy.
The problem was, you see, that for instance, the Jadaville thing, there's a very good book, actually, I'd recommend it to any of your listeners interested, Ireland, the United Nations and the Congo by Michael Kennedy and Art McGuinness. Okay. And Art McGuinness was actually a captain there in the Irish Army in the Congo. But the impression I get was that there was an attempt to cover up various errors and mistakes made by the UN in the Congo. And it involved probably top diplomats in Ireland as well as top politicians as well as the UN, because nobody wanted to embarrass the UN. That was the same with the UN. So they didn't want to draw attention to, for instance, the Jadaville. The Irish soldiers should never have been sent there. And that was one of the big embarrassing reasons.
Now, could it have been a plane crash, Carl?
There was various allegations. One was that I think there was a tape recording of a radio transmission, which is supposed to have come from the plane, and that suggested that maybe someone had tried to force their way into the cockpit and the pilots lost control. But I think that's been debunked. There is a feeling that it must have been shot down by some sort of aircraft.
In 1962, Rhodesian inquiry, now Zimbabwe obviously, concluded that pilot error was to blame, while a later UN investigation could not determine the cause of the crash, and there's evidence suggesting that the plane was shot down, and a CIA report claimed that the KGB was responsible. So it's a complete and total...
It's a total mess.
Okay, Jim Henry, you're listening to this incredible story of this man who's named on a headstone in Mount Jerome Cemetery in Harold's Cross in Dublin, beautifully kept. We've now discovered that there was a coffin in the grave, but his sister, one of his two surviving siblings, Lizzie, because of the nature of what happened, we believed, and she believes, that the coffin, unfortunately, is empty. Jim, your point about Frank being in the Gardaí and being seconded to the UN, what would the protocol be there?
Protocol in those days, Joe, I went out in 1978, and you had to resign from the Gardaí.
Ah.
There was no system of secondment.
Okay.
You had to resign, and there were two occupations, if you like, that could come back into the Gardaí, leave and come back. Those were people who joined the Gardaí, or who joined the United Nations, had a certificate of fitness that you came back with everything okay, and then you had to reapply to get back in. And you might have waited, I waited maybe a month, 6 weeks to get back in again. But that was the system up until recently. Now, there was a few of us in Jerusalem. I went to Jerusalem at the time.
Okay.
And there was a few of us from the Gardaí in Jerusalem at the time as well. So we had all to resign. Some came back, some didn't.
Sorry to be pernickety, Jim. But when you resigned from the Gardaí, when you had to resign, I didn't know this, that if you went to work for the UN as a Garda, up to 1978, which is a long time ago. So I hopefully it's changed. Well, like, would you lose pension rights and entitlements?
Yes, you kept what you had.
Yeah.
But from that day forth, you lost everything, and you just a complete break from the Gardaí at that stage. And you were a civil servant of the United Nations. You were an employee of the United Nations for that year, or whatever length you stayed in it.
Okay, but were you automatically allowed back into the Gardaí?
No. Okay. I had to come back in, apply again, and do a medical again, and do all of that to get back in again. So it was scary enough if you wanted to leave and if you wanted to come back again. Now, we came back after a year. We had a great year in Jerusalem back in 1978, 79. Okay. my wife Sheila and myself. And
had you ever heard of Frank Ivers?
I did. Okay. I did. I heard, yeah. And where, there was another Frank.
Yeah.
There was another Frank Ivers working with you in Jerusalem at the time, in the Middle East at that time as well.
Okay.
And I knew him. Very briefly, though. He was.
Oh, yeah. He was fairly well up in the in Jerusalem, actually. Yeah. Frank Ivers, his first posting was in Jerusalem as well.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Okay. And let me bring in Lua Shine. Lua, good afternoon. Joe at RTE.ie. Joe at RTE.ie, 51551. Lua, your father's connection with Frank Ivers, this grave in Mount Jerome that has no remains in it, because unfortunately and tragically, because it was an air disaster with the UN Secretary General, Frank's remains were never recovered. Your connection, Lua?
When I heard the name Frank Ivers being mentioned by the gentleman who saw his grave, I immediately said to myself, I bet you a dollar that's the Frank Ivers that my dad taught. And then, of course, as it progressed, yes, it definitely was. And what's his sister's name again?
Lizzie.
Yeah, so it's
Lily, do you remember me? I was Lua Shine. He went to school in Ballybay, didn't he?
Oh, yeah, yes.
Yeah, well, I'm Lua, and my father, Owen, taught in Ballybay. Always used to say to me that he was one of the most intelligent students that he had ever had.
Wow.
And I remember him saying that to me at the time, and he was very upset when he heard that he had died. And, like, for days afterwards, he'd say, oh, what a waste of an absolutely wonderful mind.
Oh, God. Yeah. And Lua, were you aware that there is a grave in Mount Jerome in Dublin?
No, I never knew at the time when the plane blew up, we assumed that there wasn't going to be any remains.
Yeah, well, there is.
And I don't remember there ever having been like a funeral mass in Ballybay.
Yeah, Lizzie said that.
That I can remember.
There wasn't a funeral, but there is a grave. And it's I know people ramble through graveyards and pay respects to people they know and don't know and wonder at the mystery. But if you find Frank Ivers' grave as you're walking through Mount Jerome, stop and reflect for a minute. Even though the grave is empty, he was obviously a remarkable man.
His spirit is there, even if his body isn't.
Yeah. Okay. Well put. And your father was called Owen Shine. Thank you, Lua.
Yes.
Joe at RTE.ie, 51551 is the text number. Back after this.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
So we're talking about, a mystery, somewhat solved today, having spoken to the sister of a man whose name is on a grave in Mount Jerome called Frank Ivers. It turns out Frank Ivers was killed in 1961 in a plane crash, and he was the personal bodyguard. He was Irish, from Kiltoom in County Roscommon. He was an Irish guard who was seconded, but as Jim pointed out, he probably had to leave the Gardaí to go and work in the UN, only 28 years of age. He seconded to work as a personal bodyguard to the UN Secretary General. And a month after he was married, at the age of 28, Frank was on the plane, obviously with the UN Secretary General and 13 other people. And they were flying to try and make peace in the Congo, as it was then, and Katanga. And we all know the names of Jadaville from the thousands of Irish soldiers who served so honourably there. But Frank was on the plane when there was a disaster. Nobody knows the cause of the disaster, but nothing was recovered. But Frank's headstone is in Mount Jerome in Dublin. Lizzie, would you like Frank's name to be more remembered, or would you like it to be on that memorial in Dublin Castle? I wonder now if he was a guard at that time.
I'd like him to be remembered, you know, for what he did. You know, because he did a lot of good work that we didn't even know.
Okay. And do you mind me asking you, Lizzie, did his young wife, Frank was only 28, so I presume Marie was very young as well.
Oh, she was 21 or 2.
And I think you told me she worked as a secretary in the Irish Times in Dublin prior to her marriage.
Yeah.
And did the family keep in touch with her? Do we know what happened to Marie? Did she remarry? And
well, she did.
Yeah, okay.
She remarried. Okay. Yeah, and she died young too as well. And her daughter is in the United Nations now.
Oh, imagine. Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's very, very great pride now throughout the family. Walter Kilcullen, Walter, you did two missions in the UN.
That's right, Joe. Yeah.
And did you know of Sergeant Garda Sergeant Frank Ivers?
Well, I did because I was stationed in Kevin Street for 21 years.
Okay.
And I was aware of the Kevin Street connection, and I think if memory serves me correct, Joe, he was married in Francis Street Church.
Okay.
And his wife, Marie, I think
Dublin,
she was from Bacar or Harris Cross. That would be the reason he's been buried in Mount Jerome.
Ah.
Excellent,
yeah.
I have the other side of the story is, Joe, that's why I rang in, because you were confused
okay.
and asking could his name be put on the memorial, the Hall of Honour.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid it can't, because at that time, unfortunately, Frank, like many of his colleagues, had to resign.
Ah.
Had to resign, and they were no longer members of Garda Síochána. Some of them came back, and as a previous caller has said, he's a UN veteran as well, they had to reapply again and go through medical and the whole shebang, and they lost all their allowances and pensions while they're away.
Okay.
That changed. I joined the Garda Síochána in 1972,
okay.
and that was still the role. But some years afterwards, I'm not sure, but it changed. And now you were seconded. You were seconded. And what happens is you keep your allowances. You get a very basic, say if your wife is at home, she will get your pay, a basic flat pay,
okay.
and the UN pay your supplementary pay as well. So you end up making a few pounds, but with everything else, you don't make a whole lot. But it's a wonderful experience.
Yeah,
but
okay.
you come back, and the normal any UN duty is 6 months. The army do 6 months. One that's a tour, but the Gardaí do 12 months, because six months isn't long enough to get initiated and where you are. You need the 12 months, you know. So. That's the story. Well, God rest Frank. I was very young, and I remember I was only about 9 or 10 years old when that crash happened. I remember listening on the radio on my own. It was a big thing, a big crash. And Dag Hammarskjöld was very well known because he was doing a lot of great work at the time.
Yeah, he was.
And it's such an unusual name, it sunk in my mind. And then I heard that there was a guard, an ex-Garda on the plane, an Irishman killed in it as well.
Yeah, well, there
and then when I came to Kevin Street, he's still remembered there now. I was there in the old station. There's a new station now and new people. But the older brigade were well aware of Frank Ivers and Kevin. That was his only station before he went to UN.
Ah, and would it be, it's an incredible new modern building. And would it be, do you know, Walter, is there a plaque to Frank Ivers in Kevin Street?
I don't recall. There is one, Joe.
Yeah, yeah.
And that would be the ideal place for it, I think.
Yeah, okay, good point.
I could be mistaken now, but I don't recall. But I know that there was an awareness of him having been stationed there on his death.
Okay.
And the connections locally in Francis Street and Harold's
Corner. Of course, you're right. Francis Street, the church around the corner.
Saint Marta
without the walls, it's called.
Yeah.
just outside the old city wall. And then, as Lizzie said, his young widow went on to marry and have children, one of whom she thinks is now working in the United Nations.
Many
people are asking, there's a Frank Ivers who played for Galway, fantastic player, in 1959, and there it's not the same person.
It's not the same person.
Yeah. Okay.
A lot of confusion. It's quite an
unusual name. Okay.
I think Frank we're talking about was from Roscommon, from Kiltooman, Roscommon. He wouldn't be far from another colleague of mine who was killed tragically here in County Meath back in the 80s, Frank Hand.
Frank Hand.
He was from the same area in Kiltooman, Roscommon. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Walter. That's Walter Kilcullen. And Lizzie Dolan, kind regards to you and your sister.
Yeah.
And thanks, I know you've already said it, thanks to the niece in Dublin who still looks after the grave in Mount Jerome. And long may your brilliant brother be remembered, Lizzie.
I hope so, because... And thanks very much for bringing it up.
Here's another. Well, it was Carl Martin who spotted the grave on Sunday. Claire Brophy. Claire, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. Good afternoon, Joe. Joe, Lizzie will know me as Claire Mannion from Bela because Lizzie worked for my dad.
Okay.
Hello, Lizzie. Lizzie, we could never forget. I'm great. Lizzie, we could never forget Frank because we clearly remember the devastation in the whole parish and everywhere when Frank was killed. And my dad and my brother Cyril, who's listening in England right now, and my sisters in America, they're all listening, Lizzie. And we remember that our dad went up to the airport and brought Cyril with him when the remains or whatever was the remains came. And, you know, it was just a very, very sad time. And then it was very quickly, not forgotten, but the family just seemed to have been sidelined in some way. And it really was, it felt very unfair at the time, I have to say. And can I just say, All of the Ivers family were one brighter than the other, just Frank. Lizzie was a very bright lady and she was very good to us when we were children growing up. So I just want to tell Lizzie we haven't forgotten.
Okay, did you know Frank's father and mother?
Yes, I did. Well, his father was a most brilliant sign writer and wrote the names over the shops, including our shop. And
where would that be now, Claire? Man,
that's in Baileach. It was in Baileach alone. And I remember at least twice when, and he was also called Frank, if I remember. I'd have to double check with Lizzie, the dad.
Yeah.
He was a beautiful man, lovely, lovely man. And he was lovely to us children. And he'd be hours up the ladder as an elderly man, handwriting the signs.
What a skill.
And did the same in the town. So
I wonder if there are any shops in Athlone that still have the beautiful signwriting work of Frank Ivers. Thanks indeed, Claire and Lizzie.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Pat Fagan in Aberhill in Dublin. Pat, good afternoon.
How are you? Yeah.
Frank Ivers.
Yes. His name is on the memorial plaque in Aberhill.
Brilliant.
It's actually the UN veterans.
Okay, I know
it's
well. Yeah.
Iomba. Yeah, Iomba Post 1. And all the people that were killed, civilians and army or guards that were killed overseas, are on those plaques.
Okay, and where are those headstones in Aberhill in relation to the patriots who were buried there?
Right behind the wall.
What do you mean behind the wall?
Where the patriots are buried, there's a door to the right of that.
I know.
And you go through that door, there's the garden. I look after the gardens. And then the memorial stones are just there. And we have a wreath laying there every May.
Okay. And can the public get through that door into that garden?
Yes, they can. They can. Okay. It's open to the public. It's open to the public a couple of hours every day.
Excellent. Okay. Okay. Well, Liz, that's well remembered and well kept, Frank, or Pat.
Yes.
And Aberhill is such an important part of our history, really important. And now to discover that Frank Ivers is remembered on a piece of granite, or what way is it done, Pat?
Oh, we have one section for the Congo, which was the early days, and then we have Cyprus with my own brother alone. He was killed in 1968 at the same age of 28.
Okay.
And yeah, that's Cyprus. And then you have another one beside that, that's Lebanon. And then you have different places like Chad and stuff like that. And
okay.
any civilian that served with the field service and that died overseas would be on that.
Okay. And you're adamant that Frank Ivers' name is on it?
He is, because we sent off the headstones earlier this year to get them redone.
Make sure
his name was in the Congo. So his family and anybody else related to these people can come up and lay wreath and see it any day of the week you want.
Okay. Lizzie, that's a little bit of news there. That Frank, your brother, is remembered quite close to where the 14 patriots who were executed murdered by the British after the 1916 rising, are buried. And that door, I was only up there, as I said to somebody last Sunday week, and that door is to the right. And was open that day. I didn't know you could go in, but now I know.
Oh, yeah.
Lizzie, there is, your brother's name is forever remembered in Arbour Hill in Dublin, which is magnificent.
That's good.
Okay, Lizzie, mind yourself. He was obviously a great man, and you're a great family. Yeah, anyway. And look after yourself.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Okay, that's Lizzie. Thank you. That's Lizzie Dolan in Kiltoom. Carl Martin, thanks, and all our other callers. Joe at RT.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Now, another fascinating story, also from Mount Jerome Cemetery. I happened to hear a fair bit of it on Sunday on the wonderful history show produced by Larkin Clancy, presented by the brilliant Miles Dungan. And Ronan Kelly, formerly of this parish, but now with the Dock on One team. Ronan, how did you, where does your Mount Jerome story begin?
Hiya, Joe. It was a couple of years ago. I was walking through the cemetery in Mount Jerome to see another grave. And as you know, it's impossible to rush through cemeteries because there's so much reading in the cemeteries. And I look at every headstone and I see it as a sort of a cliffhanger. And I came across this grave that had the death of a Nigerian woman marked on the headstone, which, you know, nowadays would not be so unusual. But the date of her death was 1965.
Okay.
And, you know, you're similar age to me. You would never see African people, very, very few in Ireland. And I remember emigrating to the States in the 80s, and you'd have African people, say, black people saying to you, are there many African people in Ireland? And you'd say, well, there's one or two up around the College of Surgeons, but other than that, you don't see them. Anyway, I was fascinated. This is gravestone was for a woman named Funmi Aina, and it said late of Lagos, and it said she was born in the 1940s and she died in 1965, and so she was in her early 20s.
Okay.
And I was intrigued. I just thought, wow, what was a woman from Nigeria doing in Ireland in her early 20s? Was she studying? What was she doing?
Yeah.
And because I work on the Documentary on One, I was interested. I thought perhaps we could make a documentary about it and find out what happened. And I contacted Mount Jerome authorities, and they told me that she was the only one in the grave, that the grave was paid for by somebody named Lawrence, but from Lagos in Nigeria, and that was it. That was all the information they had. So I went to the newspapers in Pierce Street Library, which I know you're familiar with.
Yeah,
on
Gilbert
the
Library.
Yeah. And I decided I'd look for her death notice. You know, I thought I might just give it a little bit of information about Robert. Couldn't find a death notice, and instead found a newspaper report saying Nigerian girl's death treated as murder. And it didn't say what happened to her, why she was treated as murder or whatever. So then I went around the corner to Lombard Street to the Births, Marriages and Deaths and asked for her death cert.
Yeah.
And when the clerk came out with her death cert, the clerk's face was white. And they handed me the death cert, and it said that she died as a result of complications due to an abortion.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so then I went back around to Pierce Street and had a look at the papers again.
Yeah.
And a few months later, there was a young Nigerian student named Augustin Adebiye, Adekunle Adebiye.
Okay.
And he was in Bolton Street, and he was charged with her murder.
Oh.
And because he was charged with procuring an abortion, and her death as a result. And he denied the charges, but he was put on trial.
Mm.
And then the story of the trial, when you read it in the papers, is heartbreaking. Because you have the story of this young fella who really seems to have been caught up in this tragedy that he had no idea what was going on.
Okay.
And what happened was, on the evening that she died, she arrived at his flat. They'd been going out as boyfriend and girlfriend. He was terrified anyone would find out that he was going out with his boyfriend and girlfriend, because he had promised his parents in Nigeria that he would not go out with a girl until he qualified. And he didn't want anyone to know that she was in his flat. But she arrived in his flat, and she said she was feeling unwell, and he was studying, and he told her to, said to her to lie down on the bed behind him. And then at one point he turned around and he put some towels on her because she was very, very hot, and he saw froth coming from her mouth.
God.
So he called a taxi, got her in the taxi, had an argument with the taxi driver trying to get her to what was called St. Kevin's at the time, but it's St. James's Hospital,
yeah.
carried her in through the doors of the hospital. A nurse met him, and he said, can you help her? And she said, no, she's dead.
Good God.
And you just had this image of this young Nigerian guy, hadn't a clue what was going on. Mm-hmm. He was in Bolton Street doing engineering, and he rang the father of one of his classmates who he had been out in this house several times, and he was a man named Superintendent Michael Wall. And mm-hmm. he came in, and he took Augustine, brought him home, brought him to his flat, brought him to Funmi's flat, told her flatmates or whatever that she had died. And then the next day, she had a sister who lived out in the school in Selbridge called St. Wolston's, that's now closed.
Yeah.
And he went down to her, and he knew her quite well because she knew he was going out with her sister. And he told her, oh, Funmi is sick. You need to come to the Nigerian embassy, and brought her up to the Nigerian embassy. Mm-hmm. And there she was told that her sister had died. And he was then, as I say, charged with murder because he was supposed to procure an abortion. And the newspapers are very coy. They wouldn't say what was going on because they were told by the court not to talk about abortion and not to talk about this, that and the other.
My gosh.
It turned out that somebody knew, somebody testified in court that she had had what they called intimate relations with somebody who knew, who had medical knowledge. And earlier on in that day, she had had an injection to cause an abortion. And she had arrived at his flat. And that's how come the blame was laid on him. And the jury took about 2 hours after hearing all the evidence and after having been advised by the judge, they had to be absolutely sure that he had injected her. It took them 2 hours and they acquitted him. So what happened then was he cheered in the court. There was lots of Nigerian students around him. And then from my point of view, he disappeared.
Gone.
I went looking for him. I would have thought, you know, Augustine Adebiye Adekunle, got to be an easy name to find. I found a man in London who works in a catering company, similar age, exact same name. No, wrong man. Contacted several people, journalists, researchers, newspaper people in Nigeria. They said, you don't have a hope of finding him. I found a reference to an obituary that a man of that name died in 2017, but no word of where he is or his girlfriend's sister, Elizabeth Ronke Aina, whether she went back to Nigeria or what happened. And what I really wanted to know was, as I say, the headstones are like cliffhangers. You know, you're told this woman dies. She's in her early 20s. She must have been absolutely terrified that afternoon.
Can you imagine?
He must have been.
Can you imagine?
You know, and the prosecution brought up all the stuff about that she died and she had no underwear on when he brought her to the hospital. But then the police, the guards found underwear in the drain of his house with, you know, bloody cloth and things like that. So she didn't, obviously knew something was going wrong. He hadn't an idea. And I also wanted to know what was she like. She was a commerce student in UCD. As I say, he was in Bolton Street in engineering. What was Dublin like at the time? 1965. There must have been a handful of African students. You know, they it was lively, it was interesting, and then all of a sudden all of this happened to them. And I was hoping to make a documentary about it, and I've been trying for a couple of years to find out information, but they've disappeared. And the only information that's left, as I said on the history show, is the microfilms in Pierce Street Library, the information in the births, marriages and deaths, and then there's a couple of lines on her headstone, that just a couple of lines of poetry and a reference to a man named Lawrence in Lagos.
Give us her full name again, the characters in this incredible story. Her name was Funmi?
So her name was Funmi Aina. Now, I'll do my best not to mangle the pronunciation.
Yeah, but the spelling.
It's Olufunmilio Abiola Aina. Her sister is Elizabeth Ronke Aina, and she was in St. Wolston's School in Selbridge. And his name was Augustine Adekunle Adebiye, and he was in Bolton Street in Dublin.
Okay.
And the guards that helped him was Superintendent Michael Wall.
Okay, so there might be, though. You're still looking for information.
Yeah, and you know yourself, if that happens now, there'd be pictures, there'd be all sorts of things, but there was nothing. There was very little. There was court reports, but you just were kind of imagining the sense of bewilderment and fear that he must have had because he was the last person to see her.
Yeah.
And obviously the superintendent realised that he hadn't a clue what was going on. One of the doctors in the hospital said he was completely bemused. He said to the nurse, but why did she die so young? You know, he had what had happened, you know, that this had visited his door. And then I often wondered what his life was like afterwards. Did he go back to Nigeria? How did he pick up the pieces? What was her sister's life? You know, she's away. She's in a boarding school in Ireland. She's an African young woman. And what happened to her since? And all from a headstone in Mount Jerome.
So you believe the sister was a student in St. Wolstan's?
St. Wolstan's, and St. Wolstan's closed.
And the sister's name again was?
Elizabeth Ronke.
Elizabeth Ronke, okay.
Yeah, okay. And it's interesting because the school closed down, it's impossible to find
records.
Records. I can't get records on old students in Bolton Street, 1965, long time ago. And, you know, nowadays when we're making documentaries and the documentary on one and we're looking for people, you can go to Ancestry.com, you can get DNA, all that kind of thing. And they've been very successful for us. But obviously, you hit a brick wall with something like this. Okay. And it's a pity because it's such a bald story on a headstone. And you'd love to fill it out. You'd love to know, what was she like?
Well, there you are now. For people, well, in the first instance, anyone who is in Mount Jerome and Harold's Cross, and you do see the headstone with Fumi's name on it, you be aware now of the story. God rest her, and the tragedy that she went through. And I know other women. I know Mamie Cadden, who was known as the Backstreet Abortionist, operated out of Hume Street there in Dublin. Right. She had died in 59. So. Obviously, but that was the awful, awful, awful times for women that were there in Dublin long after the 1960s and long before as well. Ronan, thanks indeed. And if we hear anything, we let you know. It's a fascinating Great. Piece of detective work once again. That's Ronan Kelly from the Doc on One team. Joe@rte.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And we'll tweet in a few minutes the photographs of Frank Ivers. And there is actually a website called Justice for Dag Hammarskjöld, which the UN Secretary General, Frank was his bodyguard, was killed obviously in the same plane disaster. But we'll give you more information on that. And if anyone has any information on those names that... Ronan Kelly mentioned from the 60s in Bolton Street, UCD, St. Wolstan's in Selbridge. There's a couple of leads there. Please get in touch with us. Okay, back to scams and learnings from scams. Carmel Barrett. Carmel, good afternoon.
Hello, Joe.
What? How much?
$2,864, I think. I called it $3,000.
My God, and how did they get that off you?
Well, my phone rang and I answered it. I didn't recognise the number and I could hear no voice on the other side. So I put it down. Then the phone rang again from that same number. And I said, I must have said, is that you, Rob? My son is called Robert.
Okay.
So next thing, I get a text from that number saying, hi, Mum, it's Rob.
Okay, here we go. Off to tell us what happened.
Yeah, so I'm a bit upset here. It's a message like that.
Yeah, of course.
I can't. My own phone is broken, and I can't even speak on this phone. So take this number down, and we'll be able to text one another.
Okay.
And Joe, because I'm so forgetful, I put into that number immediately, Rob, son.
So
I'd recognise it. So the next message then was, I'm afraid actually I'm in trouble, Mum. And I said, what is wrong? And he said, just... And I said to him, look, tell me, what is wrong, in a text message again? And he said, I need to pay a debt collector. And I text him and said, how in the name of God did you get anywhere near a debt collector? Now, I represented my son, or I thought wrongly of him, because in my heart, I knew he never would be in trouble with a moneylender. However, I was in such a state that I said to myself, okay, he's in trouble. And I said, well, then what do you want me to do? So he said, you know, Revolut. And I said, Revolut? I know nothing about Revolut.
Okay. Yeah,
and
yeah.
He sent back a ha-ha message, you know, ha-ha, Mum. Try and transfer from your card. Between the jigs and the reels, anyway, yeah. He supplied me with a bank number, a name and address, and a bank account number, and I was to go into the bank first thing in the morning and transfer it and mark it urgent. And I went into the bank and I told the girl my story. Not once did I think of ringing Rob's actual number.
Yeah.
But the bank girl didn't come up with that either. And I'm saying about my son. So I marked it urgent. And the next thing, I get a message saying, thank you, I've got that now. And then I was saying to myself, God, I thought Rob would say more to me, you know.
Yeah, of course.
And I was a bit annoyed, so I didn't text that number again. But the next day, my son rang. And I said, oh, so your phone is fixed. And he said, what are you talking about?
Oh, my God.
And I said, Rob, I went into trouble of transferring money. I was down at the bank. I didn't sleep a wink all night. And I transferred this money to you because you said you owed. And he said, Mom, I don't know what you're talking about. And, of course, then, it was only then I realised it was a scam. So I got on to the general bank number, you know, and I told them the full story. And anyway, it turns out that I'm not getting my money. Oh, and it was a Revolut account, apparently, that I put that money into.
Okay, yeah, you understand.
But
that,
also a name and address and everything.
And the killer blow was that when you got the first phone call, you said, is that you, Rob?
Yeah. Yeah, that was the killer blow, Joe. Yeah, of course. Okay. I thought it was my darling son. and
what does what did he say to you when he discovered this rigmarole? And not just a rigmarole, the fact that you're nearly 3,000 gone.
He said, in the name of God, Mum, why didn't you ring me? And I said, that everyone will be telling me that now, Rob.
Okay.
Everyone. And I would be saying it to everyone, but I was in a state of confusion and anxiety, and that's how they get the mothers. Apparently, it's the one they're playing an awful lot now.
They're playing it an awful lot.
Yeah.
Well, if it's any consolation to you, Catherine, I know your call is going to save a lot of people over the next few days who get a similar call, and hi, this is Mom. Can you ring me on this number, or Dad, or whatever? Ring me on this number.
Yeah.
My mobile is gone, and then the rigmarole starts.
Yeah.
And for people to be extraordinarily careful about it.
Absolutely. Okay. And just double check their actual son or daughter's number.
Yeah.
And
talk to
out.
Them. Yeah. Talk to them.
And quickly.
Recognize the voice. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Has it ever happened to you before, Carmel?
No, never, ever, ever, and hopefully
will
never, ever
happen again.
Yes.
Oh, you've a great.
I don't know why I'm laughing.
You have a great attitude. You're brilliant. You're brilliant. I hope Rob knows he has a fantastic mother.
I hope he does too.
Because he surely has.
Thank you a million, Joe. Yeah. It was lovely. And you know, it needs to be put out there.
Yeah, well done, yeah.
I presume the banks, you know, should be more aware than us individuals. Yeah. But look, that's the way it happened, and that's it. And the money is gone, and I could have had a lovely holiday.
Okay. Well, the nominee for the Mother of the Year 2023... on Lifeline. Hang on. I'll open the envelope, Carmel. See what's name is on. Hang
so
on.
Much.
And the winner is... Oh, my God, it's Carmel Barrett, Mother of the Year 2023. Carmel, come up to the stage.
My head is now absolutely bursting with pride, Joe. Thank you.
Okay,
so
well
much.
Done, Carmel.
Thanks a million.
Okay.
Love your program.
Thank you. Very kind. You're
thank
so
you.
Kind. Thanks, Carmel. That's Carmel Barrett. Paul, another scam. Paul, what happened?
Oh, well, it's not so much a scam. It's interesting to hear that, but maybe it's tied in, Joe. Don't know.
over the last year, I get calls from people saying, I've got a missed call from your number.
Okay.
And I haven't called them. You back check the log, you haven't called them, don't know them. Now, some people are very irate. Some people are fine. And you kind of say, have you had, I've had this. And they say, yeah, we get this from time to time too. It's kind of like it throws up. I was talking to somebody and they said, so I had one call yesterday and I had another one this morning saying, you know, missed call from this number. And I was talking to somebody else and they said they'd phoned, I'm with Three, and they said they talked to Three and Three said it's a scam, the number's been hacked. But there's nothing they can do about it. There's nothing we can do about it, apparently. Yeah. But, you know, we should tell people, you know, obviously don't do what that last lady does, is get involved in any transfer of funds. But it seems really odd. I just wonder if it's happening with any other network.
Your number has been hijacked.
I don't know. I have no idea. All I know is that people are getting calls from this number. They're saying missed calls. It's not a pocket call because, like, I'd be redialing somebody, you know, I'd already called or something like that. You know, they're not numbers. So I suppose maybe it has been hijacked. I don't know. I don't know.
Okay. But it really is double check. And
double check. And I just wonder if
double check off. Double check. Yeah, using your own numbers. Yeah. Don't press links and don't press call back either.
Certainly don't. Well, if you call back, don't give any details unless you know. Obviously, people are generally very courteous, you know. But I just say, I've no idea. I didn't call you. You know, not from me.
Okay.
But maybe other people have some different experiences.
That's what Live Line's all about. Yeah, appreciate it, Paul.
Go to Mila Market.
That's Paul. Suzanne Breen. Suzanne, good afternoon.
Good evening. Or good afternoon, Joe.
Tell us your connection with Frank Ivers.
So this is all a bit sudden for me because I just got a phone call from Brenda. So basically, my connection to Frank Ivers would be through my granddad, who was John Walsh, which was the Francis Street photographer. So many people would know him. So just in relation to his funeral, obviously in my archive and in my research in the archive, I found Frank Ivers' funeral, the pictures, the images. So the documentary that we did 2 years ago, we returned those images to his family.
Oh, well done.
Yeah, on RTE, so it's there on the player.
And you have, there are photographs of Frank Ivers' funeral.
Yeah, well, we think, see, because Frank was stationed in Kevin Street, which would have been just beside Francis Street, and Frank's family has said he was big into photography, so on his walks or on his beat, he may have called into my granddad and had a chat, but also, 1 month prior to Frank passing away, my granddad did his wedding photograph. So we think the reason that my granddad maybe went to his funeral to take pictures was the fact that he had just only taken this young man
4 weeks previously. And are there photographs of the wedding around?
There probably is in the archive,
That's incredible, And what was the name of your documentary on your father, or your grandfather, Tom?
The 50 Francis Street Photographer.
Ah, magic.
So we went down and brought the images back to the family because Frank got a state funeral, but they kind of didn't get a chance to be involved and they never got a chance to get close to Frank, you know, or... So we brought them back the photographs of him being buried and in the house.
That was excellent. Yeah, well done.
So they do exist.
Well done. Okay, well done. And thanks. Thanks, Suzanne. Suzanne Breen. Joe at RTE.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And Joe at RTE.ie. Frank Breheny has contacted us. Frank, yesterday, September the 11th, obviously in many people's minds, the memoriam of the great tragedy in the United States, the terrorist attack.
Indeed.
But it's also the 30th anniversary of something you want to be remembered. Go ahead, Frank.
Yesterday was the 30th anniversary of the reinterment of 154, women, Magdalen women, who were former inmates of the High Park Laundry in Dublin.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very important, I think, anniversary, very solemn, partly because of the circumstances around the exhumation of those women from High Park, the lack of death certificates during the exhumation process, difficulties in establishing names even to this present day, and indeed question marks over their place of rest. So there is a cross in Glasnevin Cemetery, and I've been there several times because it is said that my grandmother rests there too. And it's simply, it was important to me to mark the 30th anniversary because whilst there are those who probably think that their stories are ended, I don't think that that is the case, and I certainly don't think that that's the case in the minds of the other 150 or so families.
And the High Park was in Drumcondra in Dublin. There was a graveyard there. There wasn't individual headstones, and then they were interred or reinterred in Glasnevin Cemetery, again back to cemetery. And that was what 30 years ago yesterday. That interment took place.
That's correct, yes. I mean, it was, again, controversial because having done quite a bit of research on this, it appears from the media coverage at the time, there were no families present, which means that the women were, for the second time, not remembered by their families or being offered any kind of remembrance. And that's why it's important, I think, to commemorate their memories.
Okay. Unfortunately, the line is deteriorating, Frank, but it's an incredible endeavour on your part, and I know you've got more information as well. That's Frank Breheny in the UK. Monty Blay. Monty, good afternoon.
Hello, how are you?
So you're in Sandy Mount in Dublin. Fumi Aina, that Ronan Kelly. Tell us what you remember.
Well, I only came in on the halfway through the spot, so I don't quite know what was being talked about. But when I heard the name from the Aina, I remember her. I was in school with her in a Leaving Cert class in a school called, it used to be called Willie Martin's. It was on Mount Street beside Hollis Street. And I don't know what the official name was, either the Mount St. Fergus Academy or Blackrock Academy.
And was it a school, Monty, or was it a grind school, as they say?
It had been a grind school, but it had come under the auspices of the Department of Education, so he became official. He split the house into two schools, a girls' school upstairs and a boys' school downstairs. It was a bit of a madhouse, but it was a kind of a last chance. There's all sorts of misfits and oddballs there. And I do remember her in the class. She was a very... I have this roundy sort of plumpish woman, a very, very nice personality and very, very bright because she was good at maths. I wasn't bad either. And we used to cooperate in telling the teacher how to solve different problems. But I just thought I heard the name.
And Monty, what age would you have been when you met Fumi?
I would have been 18.
Okay.
Maybe 1963.
Okay, and was she from a wealthy family in Nigeria? Did you know anything about her background?
I didn't. I wouldn't say I was a close personal friend of hers, but we used to, as a sort of a classmate, and we talk about this and that, you know.
Okay. But, did you know, Monty, that Fumi died during a botched abortion? She died shortly thereafter, and she's buried up in Mount Jerome in Dublin.
I didn't know that. I knew that she, I'd heard some years later that she had died because of that. Somebody had attempted a termination on her, and it didn't go well. And I was very sorry to hear it, but it was some years later that I heard it. I didn't know she was buried here.
Yeah, she is buried here in Mount Jerome.
Yeah. I also heard the name Adebayi. I went on to Bolton Street College. Floundering there for some years trying to do an engineering course. And there was a... I didn't hear the whole program, so I don't know what the association was.
Yeah, well Adebayi was Fumi's boyfriend. And he was... he's the one, when she came back from the botched... abortion. He's the one who took her to hospital, and he's the one that was charged but acquitted obviously, because he didn't do it. He was charged with procuring an abortion. So it was a very difficult story. With your permission, Monty, afterwards, with your permission, I will give you the phone number, the contact details for Ronan Kelly, who's investigating who's investigating the story, and it came across the headstone. Okay, Monty, thanks indeed. Thanks for another little piece in that jigsaw. Ashton Grufferty is on Buzz and Sound. BCO is Shane Galvin. Producer Sean O'Gorman. And Ray Darcy is next.
0818 715 815 stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe@rte.ie.